From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. History is written to remember, but to what degree does memory write our history? I'm Gretchen Helfrich. As oral histories are passed from person to person, they create a foundation for how an event will be remembered. Today on Odyssey, we'll explore how individual memories interact with larger historical narratives. We understand that individual memories can distort or modify the facts of an event, but as they are transformed, what do these memories become? And how do they contribute to what eventually emerges as our collective memory? That's today on Odyssey, after this. From Chicago Public Radio, this is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Soon after the attacks of September 11th, people began to document individual experiences of the catastrophe. You probably saw it on TV, because from journalists to documentary makers, people hit the streets with video cameras and tape recorders to make recordings of the stories of survivors. A group of memory researchers circulated a questionnaire asking people where they were when the attacks happened and checking their recall of the sequence of events. However, memories are notoriously unstable, which raises a question. What might happen to people's recollections of these events over time as a larger historical version of events comes to be told? Today on Odyssey, we're going to examine how individual memories interact with history, with the big story. And joining us for the conversation are Richard Schwader, who is a cultural anthropologist and professor of human development at the University of Chicago. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Emerging Cultural Differences, The Multicultural Challenge in Liberal Democracies. He joins us today from the University of Chicago campus. We're also talking with Allison Landsberg, who is assistant professor of history and art history at George Mason University. She joins us from her home in Virginia. Hello to both of you, and thank you for being on the program.
Hi.
Richard Schwader, let me begin with you and ask you to tell me about the unreliability of memories. Memories don't document events very well. Tell me about what happens to them.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to distinguish recognition memory from recall, and especially recall in the context of a telling. Recognition memory is, in fact, very accurate, and there are studies which have shown that you can have someone flip through a magazine looking at advertisements, one a second, several hundred of them, and a week later show people what they've seen and what they haven't seen, and their recognition for what they've seen is extremely accurate. So I think if it's just a matter of recognizing something, there's a considerable degree of accuracy. When you move to recall, however, and especially recall in the context of a telling, then all sorts of changes and transformations take place. And we actually create our memories, just as we actively create our lives. And there has been a long research tradition showing the kinds of transformations that take place. There's someone named Sir Frederick Bartlett, an English psychologist, who long ago demonstrated that people over time tend to make their memories more and more coherent. And if you can tell a story or give an account of something such that other people know what you're talking about and they themselves find it entertaining and memorable, you're going to remember it that way too over time.
So, you mean you turn the memory into a story and then it becomes easier to keep?
Right. Well, you turn it into a story, and stories that have plots, that have goals, that have challenges, that have setbacks, that have obstacles, that have particular participants with certain characteristics that help you understand their motives for seeking the goals they're seeking. There's a kind of structure to the stories that we tell. And again, this has been investigated by many people interested in storytelling, this kind of elementary structure that gives something coherency. So having a character, having a goal, striving, having setbacks, overcoming challenges. We like to think about the world in that way and trace current events back to sequences of that type. So you can think of memory as a kind of communication with yourself over time, in which in some ways parallels the way in which you tell stories to others, and which is one of the ways in which collective memory and personal memory come to fit each other. There are certain, I think, sort of big principles that you can talk about when you think about this process. One is some notion of coherency. You're looking for a script with a plot that has the kind of features I just mentioned: heroes and villains, obstacles, goals, challenges, setbacks. This is very something you need a rhyme and a reason, essentially, to organize your telling and your recollection of what happened. This is sort of the opposite of Camus' L'Étranger, where events sort of happen for no rhyme or reason, and one thing leads to another, and there's no coherency, and the absurdist world is the world that's very much the opposite of the kind of desire for coherency that most people have when they think about their lives and events in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
The second kind of principle besides coherency, I would say, is hindsight. And there have been a number of people showing the considerable power that hindsight has in the way in which you remember the past. There's a famous line of Kierkegaard that life is lived forward but understood backwards. And once things have happened, of course, we're in that position where we can look back and try and figure out how we got where we are, and then we look for a thread or a theme that also requires coherency. But people are constantly rethinking and retelling and re-remembering the past once they know how things turned out.
So the narrative of any particular event, for example, what happened on September 11th, and you know, an individual's involvement or an individual's connection to it, will be reevaluated in light of what that event comes to mean later on, or how it's understood or interpreted down the line.
I think that's exactly right. From the point of view of recognition memory, if someone shows you a picture of a plane going into the World Trade Center, I think you're going to recognize it no matter what happens in the future. When it comes to narrating that event and the significance of that event, how things turn out is going to matter a lot. September 11th was a huge event, and how we're going to end up positioning ourselves spiritually and politically with regard to that event remains to be seen, because we really don't know how events are going to unfold at this point, and there are many, many possibilities.
Alison Landsberg, I was going to ask you to jump in here, because your work sort of goes in the other direction. When people take on memories of things, or use memories of things, of experiences that they didn't actually have, as a way to understand them or relate to them.
Exactly. I'm interested in the way that it's become increasingly possible over the course of the 20th century to take on memories of events that one didn't actually live through. And I call these memories prosthetic memories, because I think they actually become part of one's own archive of experience, and they feel real even though they're not authentic in a strict sense.
Could you give some examples?
Sure. I mean, I think that traumatic events from the past, like slavery or the Holocaust, events which are difficult to process or understand simply through history, are often productive sites for engaging with memory. And I think that as a culture, with these traumatic events of the past, like the Vietnam War, the Holocaust, I think that in addition to working through them historically, we have a tendency as a culture to try to work through them through processes of memory as well. And
How can we come to take on a memory that we didn't actually have?
Well, I think that this becomes possible through different kinds of technologies of memory. I think that film is a very powerful technology of memory, and I think that certain museums, like the Holocaust Museum in Washington, there are museums that are very experientially oriented, and the purpose of a museum like the Holocaust Museum, I think, is to move an individual through a particular space so that they, while they're learning about a historical narrative, they're also engaging physically with the space and with the events. And I think that having one's body positioned in a particular way as they acquire or learn about, acquire the sort of memories of an event, it becomes increasingly possible to feel that one has an actual experiential relationship to that event. I'm certainly not suggesting that people actually going through the Holocaust Museum would feel that they had anything like the experience of the Holocaust, but I nevertheless think that by being positioned, you know, when you're at the Holocaust Museum, and I can talk about this more fully, but there are certain moments when you move through the train car that was used to carry Jews to Treblinka, I think that being in the presence of objects and sort of the actual objects that were taken from Poland and Germany from this particular time, and being sort of put in proximity to those objects, creates an experience for the person. And I think that the actual act of experience there is very important in the taking on of memories. And again, it's not the taking on of an actual memory event, but having an experience in a museum allows the narrative to gain a kind of power over the individual. I think this might be connected a little bit to what Rick was talking about the importance of narrative in recall.
Well, I'm wondering also to what extent these processes relate specifically or uniquely to traumatic events, historical events that have a bodily import. You know, you talk about slavery or the Holocaust or September 11th, you know, where people's bodies were affected, people were killed, people were injured, and the experience is very much a physical one. I'm wondering if those are histories that are better or more amenably told in this way. But I'm also wondering about memory and trauma and how we change memories around trauma in ways that might be specific and different from the way we manipulate other kinds of memory. Rick Schwader?
Yeah, well, first, I'm sure that Allison would grant a distinction between memory in some literal sense of the notion memory and imagination, because, of course, one capacity that human beings have is this marvelous capacity of the creative imagination to transport you into other people's worlds and other experiences and other contexts, which often produces an experience and can have a huge impact on your life. And so it seems to me that we're talking about a class of things that would include great literature, the mythologies and origin stories of the peoples of the world, the way in which rituals are often reenactments of events which are meant to take you into that world which you yourself may not have literally been part of, but to make it a part of your way of thinking about the world, of describing the world, and ultimately of experiencing the world. And the museum techniques that she described seem to me in that class as well, but seems to me that there are a huge range of things that involve going beyond your own literal experience and taking you outside of your physical time and space. And it's like a time machine, and all time machine effects, if they're successful, will produce some kind of seeing the world from the perspective of another, with the resulting emotions and even desires that may be part of that. So it seems to me that I agree that I don't think that this is necessarily tied to traumatic events, although it may well be that those are the kinds of events that people feel a need to reenact, rehearse, and learn from.
Right. I certainly think that it's the unsettled nature of these traumatic memories that make them very vital. The events where closure is not quite possible because the memory is so unsettled, that we can, as a culture, continue to rehearse the memories in different shapes and forms.
But Allison Landsberg, to the distinction that Rick Schwader was making between memory, or what you call prosthetic memory, and imagination, you seem to focus specifically on the experience of the body and, you know, sort of physical position of the body in relation to the way a story is told.
Yeah, I'm quite interested in that. I mean, the reason I think what I'm talking about is it's connected to but different from sort of range of literature and mythology that serves similar functions, that has over time been a way that cultures produce collective memories, and the way that cultures continue to disseminate memories that are intended to preserve group identity. I mean, I think what I'm suggesting here is that it becomes increasingly possible in the 20th century to take on memories of events that are not part of one's group identity.
Now, when you say it becomes increasingly possible, are you saying that because technologies exist for capturing the memories of people who do go through an experience, it then becomes possible to simulate that experience for others and to create what I guess would be the prosthesis?
To a certain extent, but it also has to do, I think, with the commodification of memory as I see it. I think that, you know, in an age of mass culture, images and narratives about the past circulate much more widely than they ever did before, and that I think of collective memories as being community-specific, group-specific, geographically bounded in a way that I think that prosthetic memories are not necessarily so. People can share memories of a traumatic event that they didn't live through and not be part of the same group, not be part of that group. I mean, I think that what happens at the Holocaust Museum is that memories of the Holocaust become powerfully available to people who are not Jewish,
mm-hmm.
who don't have a sort of quote-unquote natural connection.
I want to come back to this distinction between prosthetic memory and collective memory and go back to the larger question of historical narrative when we come back, but we need to take a break. So we will do that and then return to our conversation about memory and history. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the University of Chicago's Humanities Open House, a day-long celebration of scholarship and arts held on October 27th. Online registration is at humanities.uchicago.edu/openhouse. Further information at 773-702-4847. This WBEZ announcement is provided by CanTV, offering Chicago residents and nonprofits a voice on cable TV with video training, equipment, facilities, and channel time. Further information is available at 312-738-1400 or online at cantv.org. Serving Northeast Illinois, Northwest Indiana, Southeast Wisconsin, and Southwest Michigan with news and culture. This is Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, and on the web at WBEZ.org. Welcome back to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we're talking about memory and history and how the two interact, connect to each other. We're joined by Richard Schwader, who is a cultural anthropologist and professor of human development at the University of Chicago. We're also talking with Allison Landsberg, assistant professor of history and art history at George Mason University. Let me come back, if I may, to this question of collective memory and the distinction between maybe collective memory and history. Because when we talk about the big story, the historical story, it's often told in terms that abstract away from individual experience. But when you were talking before, Rick Schwader, about the way we change our story, change our memories in light of the unfolding of events, it seems like we're taking on the historical narrative and adding it to our personal stories and reshaping them.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think that with regard to your question, the distinction between historical narrative and, let's say, mythic narrative is increasingly difficult to sustain and define. That's not to say it isn't important to try and make some distinctions. I do research in an Orthodox Hindu temple town on the east coast of India, where I would say both personal narratives and what you would call historical narratives are relatively unimportant and rarely narrated. And the narratives that are narrated are, the stories that are told are stories of the old time from what they call the Puranas and from their Hindu epics and scriptures, which are largely the story of events over a huge time scale in which human beings they're very distant from them in any literal sense, but are very close to them and intimate with them because of the constant reenacting of the story of gods and goddesses and battles between good and evil and demons. I was recently in Bali. And when you arrive in Bali, you can't help but be struck by the constant involvement of everyone in creating objects like huge 20-foot demons and witches who are going to be in a battle that week because there's a ceremony, it's this week's ceremony engaged involving the battle of good and evil. And that's where people's minds are. That's where their sensibilities are. They think of themselves as participating in this kind of eternal time, which is told in terms of mythic narratives about things long ago but present nevertheless. And so societies themselves vary considerably in whether or not their focus is on personal biography. For example, you rarely find personal biographies coming out of rural South Asia. If you find personal biographies, it's cosmopolitan intellectuals who are in the diaspora, for example, who are now moving to a focus on the personal self and life in what from the point of view of South Asian rural people is a very short span of time, and away from this kind of concern for these vast origin stories which are so powerful. Can I make a comment on some of the things Allison said before? I think knowing by doing, which she emphasizes, is terribly important, and there are all sorts of memories that I think are associated with motor movement and with the experience of the body. I mean, you merely have to talk to someone who does the kind of massage that's called Rolfing, which involves very deep tissue massage. And Rolfers will tell you that when they start pressing on a particular body part very deeply, producing pain, all of a sudden a rush of memories associated with that body part will come out. So I have no doubt that there's a kind of somatic association of certain kinds of experiences, a somatic encoding of certain kinds of experiences. And of course, the field I'm in, anthropology, is premised on participant observation as an important way to gain access to other people's understandings and experiences. It's not just observation in a detached way, it's actually participating in events. On the assumption that actual doing and participation will make it possible for you to understand things that are not understandable merely by observing from the outside. The other point I would make, however, is that in our cosmopolitan globalizing world, if we continue to globalize post September 11th, there is this idea that there's a free flow of everything, and all of a sudden stories and images are detached from actual groups and communities, and anyone can get on the internet and participate in anyone else's culture. I'm a little bit skeptical about that, and I actually think that whose images you choose to engage is a rather important issue, and there clearly is an issue about whether you're going to want to step into that world or see the world in that way. And I think we have to address those issues. Right now, we can select between many kinds of stories and plots about what's going to happen post September 11th. We can decide to enter into the world of the Islamic fundamentalist martyr and experience the world that way. That's available to us. Do we choose to do so? You know, what ethical issues surround that? Are particular individuals prepared to engage other people's worlds?
Alison Landsberg, this is sort of at the center of a lot of what you're thinking about, because the question of, or the practice of putting yourself in the shoes of another person and experiencing or having a simulation of their experience positions you in a way that tends to obscure other things like the political setting, the social embedding of that experience. When you keep things at the personal level, it opens up vistas and closes down others.
That's certainly true. And I absolutely agree with what Rick was saying about the availability of different narratives and how one might be, you know, directed to a particular narrative. Or, you know, I certainly think it's the case that what I call prosthetic memory, I'm trying to describe a phenomenon here. And the negative side of prosthetic memory is, of course, would be brainwashing or the use of these narratives to do ill, to sort of to try to understand the perspective of the terrorist or whatever. But what I'm interested in, though, is the power of particular mediums like film or museum to take people who wouldn't necessarily see the world through a particular set of glasses, through a particular window, and force them to see it that way. I mean, the thing that's quite powerful at the Holocaust Museum is that it really doesn't give you a lot of freedom in how you interpret the events. I mean, of course, there's a kind of melding of some of the images that you see, the narratives you see, with images in your own mind, and I think that's sort of inevitable. But people have criticized the Holocaust Museum as being, a Disneyland, precisely because it engages the experiential, the tactile, in its attempt to teach people, to have people engage with the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really short-sighted critique, because the museum, all the while, even though it's trying to engage a kind of corporeal logic, it never, for a moment, loses the historical narrative that it's also setting in place. And I think it's very difficult to move through the Holocaust Museum and not really be sort of forced to see the world through different eyes. And the question that Rick raises about how we select the narratives about the past that we end up engaging with is a huge question and a very difficult question. And I think he's absolutely right that, you know, it's certainly not the case that that all of the narratives out there about the past are in any way productive. You know, there are plenty that are not the case. I mean, I'm particularly interested in those cultural products that try very hard to produce empathy in spectators or participants. I'm interested in the film Rosewood, for example, which was about the Rosewood massacres in Florida, and it narrates the story of these two towns, and a black town and a white town, and a white woman claims that she's raped by a black man, and of course she wasn't, but then this, you know, unleashes all sorts of lynch mobs on the African-American characters. And The movie is very powerful because it really positions white viewers to see the world through black eyes in a way that I don't think we experience much in cinema today. And so, again, my point is that I think that the technologies are out there to help to engage people in these kind of ways that might enable them to see the world through different eyes and mm-hmm. might then help them to experience empathy and maybe alter their consciousness. And this is not mostly what we're seeing out there, but I'm always sort of looking for cases where this is possible because I think the technology is there to sort of help in this project. Mm-hmm.
Allison Landsberg is assistant professor of history and art history at George Mason University. We're also talking with Richard Schwader, who is a cultural anthropologist and professor of human development at the University of Chicago. We're talking today about memory and history, and we'll take some calls later on at 1-888-859-1800-1888-859-1800. Rick Schwader, I cut you off. Go ahead and respond
to Allison. Well, I wonder if I could put forward a general principle following on Allison's comments. This is a maxim that I think is central, certainly, to the field of cultural psychology in which I work. And I associate it with the philosophy of life, actually, and of science, which I have dubbed Confucianism, not to be confused with Confucianism. This is Confucianism, and this is its central maxim. The world is incomplete if seen from any one point of view, incoherent when seen from all points of view at once, and empty if seen from what's sometimes called nowhere in particular. So the choice is between incompleteness, incoherence, and emptiness, and I view that as a fundamental existential choice in the understanding of others. And given that choice between emptiness, incompleteness, incoherence, and emptiness, I can't opt for incoherence because that's just impossible. Emptiness is too distanced from experience, so I opt for incompleteness. That means seeing something from a point of view, the point of view of another, but recognizing that when you see something from any point of view, it's incomplete, which therefore requires that you begin to so-called deconstruct that perspective. Not just deconstruct it, see what you can see and what you can illuminate from that perspective, but recognize that something's being suppressed from any perspective, mm-hmm. which requires that you move on to another perspective. So the idea is that you always are staying on the move.
But are there cultural or political processes that legitimize certain perspectives and delegitimize others?
It's the perfect question. So it seems to me that if we're going to think of this as prosthetics, Allison's notion of prosthetics, then you're talking about the artificial replacement of missing parts. That's what prosthetics are about. And a number of questions arise, whether or not the techniques are artificial, which I think is a sort of, I would hesitate to see what she's describing as artificial as opposed to natural, because it seems to me it's in the nature of human beings that we are meaning creators, and hence this is part of our nature to do this, so not really artificial. And the question arises, what missing parts are we talking about? What do we think is incomplete in ourselves that would call for moving to another perspective, presumably to make ourselves more complete? And not everywhere we go is going to make us more complete. And indeed, we may go to perspectives that are going to diminish us as human beings. So we have to really distinguish between, in anthropology, it would be a distinction between a genuine and a spurious culture. I mean, which are the perspectives that we think enhance life, that lead to fulfillment, that make us richer as moral and spiritual human beings? And that requires, of course, some kind of theory of what are the variety of goods that are out there. And we need such a view before we can make any decisions about where we want to go in this process of hopping between different points of view.
No, I think that's certainly true. And I think that, I mean, I tend to think about it in terms of social justice, the perspectives that help to enhance and foster a sense of social justice and tolerance, recognition of difference. Positions like that are the ones that I hope prosthetic memories might position people to be able to recognize. And one of the distinctions I try to make is between empathy and sympathy. And the reason I'm interested in empathy is because, unlike sympathy, in which there's a presumption of sameness between you and the object or subject of inquiry, empathy presupposes a difference between the two. And to achieve empathy with another or something else requires a leap, a cognitive leap, because one doesn't know what the experience of the other is like. And I think that empathizing requires one to to try to recognize always the alterity of the other's position while trying to come to some kind of recognition that other.
Let me ask a question, kind of focusing back on September 11th and the storytelling that's already emerging from those events, you know, the accounts over and over. We're seeing individual accounts of particular experiences with respect to the attacks on the World Trade Center in particular, not so much what happened in Washington. But I'd like to know whether you see already, either of you, a privileging or a focus on certain types of stories over others. In other words, are we already saying these are the stories we want to tell and these are the stories that will help us make sense out of this, and these other stories are kind of off the table? Rick Schwader?
Well, if you're around a university in the United States, of course, there are lots of competing stories going on, and that may not be representative of the broader population. So I hear many different kinds of versions. It's interesting, I think, initially how many well-known scripts came out to think about this. First, there was the Pearl Harbor analogy. There has been recently the Munich appeasement story. The war idea emerged very quickly. What kind of war it is, we're a little bit unclear. I think for some people, one wonders whether or not positively a new world order will emerge in which there'll be some kind of global minimum rules of civility, like non-aggression across borders and no terrorism, and perhaps exit visas will be available for people who don't like where they're living so they can go somewhere else. But I think that the master narrative, if there's one that seems to be emerging, is something like a battle between liberalism and Islamic fundamentalism, with a distinction between Islamic fundamentalism of the fanatic version and the rest of Islam. But at some level, I think people are now wondering about what is a liberal society? Can a liberal society have room for fundamentalism? What's a Islamic fundamentalist fanatical vision like? Does it have room for liberalism? And I think the conclusion on the latter score is probably not. And on the first, it's an open question. And now people, at least in the worlds in which I live, who are committed to some vision of liberal society, are sensing that that's what's going on.
Alison Landsberg?
One thing that I would have to say that I find very interesting about the not so much about the narratives that are emerging out of this, but the types of memorializing activities that I've seen around the event is that there seems to me to have been, and this might already have passed at this point, but to have been a kind of tension between a kind of memorializing, a popular memorializing, a memorializing, as it were, from below, and then a memorializing from above. And what I mean by that is that, on the one hand, there was a very sort of large-scale, popular outpouring of shrines and objects and posters for the missing persons that I see as a sort of genuine popular desire to memorialize the people that were lost and the sort of the large-scale loss of this event and to put a human tragedy in a loss. And at the same time, there was the resolution passed by Congress asking American citizens to hang a flag as a kind of memorial for those who are lost and missing and dead as a result of this event. And it was quite interesting to I think, see the, I don't know if it's really a tension, but to see these two forces at work. And it seems to me to be the case that that the popular memorializing seems to have given way to this, to the kind of nationalism, the patriotism, the patriotic narratives that we still continue to see quite strongly.
Alison Landsberg, briefly before we take a break, is there any tension between telling this story at a global level, you know, these sort of bigger narratives, and telling this as the story of these individuals who went through it? Is there a tension in making that sort of history?
Well, I think that the very first response clearly was to put a human face on this tragedy. And I think that the missing posters that cover billboards and telephone booths and telephone poles in New York were a testament to that, to the desire to make public the private loss that many people experience. And the question then becomes how does that situation, that all that sort of private loss, become part of this larger global narrative.
Okay, that's a question we'll have to answer after the break, because we're going to take one now, and then we'll come back and take some phone calls as well at 1-888-859-1800. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey.
Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Concentrix, creative communication specialists dedicated to developing internal communication solutions for Fortune 500 companies. Information is available at 312-922-1950 or online at cntx.com. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Remy Bumpo Theater Company, presenting Harold Pinter's No Man's Land at Victory Gardens, now through November 11th. The Chicago Tribune writes, there are bursts of comedy amidst the gloom. Information is available at 773-871-3000. You're listening to Chicago Public Radio, WBEZ Chicago 91.5 FM, or on our website at WBEZ.org, where you can listen to our live broadcasts anywhere in the world.
Listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and today on the program we're talking about memory and history and how they interact. We're talking with Allison Landsberg, who is an assistant professor of history and art history at George Mason University. She joins us from her home in Virginia. We're also talking with Richard Schwader, who's a cultural anthropologist and professor of human development at the University of Chicago. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, Emerging Cultural Differences, the Multicultural Challenge in Liberal Democracies. We'll take some phone calls at 1-888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. Let's talk with Ivan. Hello, Ivan. You're on Odyssey.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I said, I first wanted to comment that this whole discussion of, like, prosthetic memory kind of reminds me of the phenomenon where small children kind of take on the experiences of their parents or people around them, believe it happened to them. And but my main point is I think memory kind of contributes, I guess, dramatically to an individual's belief structure, kind of because I think memory produces evidence of their quote-unquote truths about the world. And I guess my comment is I'm interested in a little bit of discussion about how homogeneity of experience leads to sort of cultural polarization. And especially considering, obviously, after September 11th, we live in a very obviously polarized world. And I wonder how, like, cultural homogeneity of memory contributes to that. And I'll just hang up and listen to your comments.
All right. Richard Schwader, would you like to respond to that?
Well, there are lots of things to say. First of all, I think memory influences belief structure. Belief structure also influences memory. In rural India, where I work, people try to figure out why they're suffering now, and they often try to remember things from long ago that might have caused it, and their time scale is not our time scale. They think recovered memories from early childhood. What's early childhood? A few years when you have a eternal transmigrating soul that's been around for a very long time. So they go to oracles and try and recover memories from former lives, and indeed they learn about things they did in former lives, and usually they've transgressed or done something that was a sin, and now they're suffering for it because nature kicks back and you reap what you sow, and then they take steps to deal with their spiritual debts. But there, the belief system makes it possible for them to move into a relationship to the past, which is very different from our own, so it goes both ways. With regard to the polarized world question, I'm not sure I can address the homogenization leading to polarization. I'm not fully clear about that point. But I do think that we need to recognize the kinds of polarities that exist both internally and externally. I mean, clearly, if you step into the world of Islamic fundamentalists who are involved in terror, they have a view of the world in which there's a battle again with the infidels. We view them as fanatics. They view us as infidels. And they view many of the things which we understand to be morally decent and rational to be acts of the devil or sinful. They don't like the way women dress. They don't like MTV. They don't like certain forms of materialism. They think this is Sodom and Gomorrah here in the United States. So there's that kind of tension in framing the world. Internally, in the United States, even the flag issue, which I don't think we have time to discuss, is a fascinating one because I certainly do know some people who, while perfectly patriotic, are uncomfortable with the symbolism of the flag as they associate it from their past with certain forms of jingoistic patriotism.
Course, right.
On the other hand, I think it's very important from the point of view of empathy to recognize that an upper, you know, there are different parts of our society, and it may be that an upper middle class candle is a lower middle class flag, and they really are structurally equivalent in what they're trying to promote and the kinds of attitudes they're trying to evoke. And then much more deeply, I think we need to recognize that within our own historical narrative, we have two narratives that are very much in tension within our own society. On the one hand, we have the Enlightenment story, which is a story of the world waking up and becoming good 300 years ago in Northern Europe. And it's associated with progress and technology and liberations of various kinds, and, you know, within our memory, with the sexual revolution, with women's liberation, with civil rights, you know, with the internet, with visa cards, with travel. I mean, you know, and you can, there are certain, you know, forms of it probably in which people think the Hard Rock Cafe ought to be all over the world because that's just a wonderful thing. But that's sort of the progress story. But along with it, we also have a counter-Enlightenment romanticist story, which actually has a very different view of the world, you know, which worries about pollution and the destruction of the environment and the bomb and chemicals that have been created, the loss of spirituality, the destruction of community, and doesn't like materialism. And even the evaluation of the 20th century within our own society, there are plenty of people who think the 20th century was the best century yet, you know, and they'll point to the telephone and electricity and the computer and all these things I mentioned. There are other people who think the 20th century was the worst century yet, you know, with genocide, with the bomb, with two huge wars that killed and displaced many people. And we have that tension within our own society. And I suspect September 11th, at some deep level, at least in the long term, is going to have resonances for all those kinds of communities. And its implications for globalization and the anti-globalization movement, which is a kind of internal dispute, dialogue, if you like, is going to be very rich.
Allison Landsberg?
Well, I think that, back to the question about belief structure, I think it certainly is a case that that memories do participate in one's belief structure. And that's why I think it's so important and interesting to interrogate memory, because memory, unlike history, has a personal component. And I think for that reason, it's more likely to motivate action on an individual's part, to make them feel differently, think differently, engage differently with the past. And so I think that this caller might be suggesting that part of the problem that we have now is that it becomes increasingly difficult to see beyond our own perspective as a nation, or some kind of our collective national identity, the America that is waving the flag right now. There's a very sort of very strong sense of homogeneity in perspective concerning the events of September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah,
let's take another call. Let's talk with Dan. Hello, Dan. You're on Odyssey.
Hi. I have a comment and a question, and I would first off like to get back to the opening or get to the opening topic. It's understandable that memory encompasses experience, interpretation, and communication. Okay, we've got that covered without going into specific historical events. My comment is that it's my observation that memory and human nature is reduced to catch words, and in the process and understanding of history, that history is corrupted and altered, for lack of better words. I would like to take something, a more current event, Bush using the term flush them out of the hole.
Smoke them out, I believe he said.
Smoke them out of the hole. That has a lot to do with impression visuals and the memory. My question is, when does memory begin to develop? At the time of an event? Or after the event, and how much longer after the event?
Okay, let's throw that question to Rick Schwader.
Well, I think all of the above, and I think a process is constantly going on in which one rethinks and reframes. And, you know, sometimes memories constructed by others become your own collective memory long after things occurred. There have been a number of observations of peoples of the world who have had anthropologists visiting them for, you know, 100 years. And after a while, they've begun to take some of the accounts that anthropologists give of as their official accounts. And those accounts may or may not be accurate, but they, at some later date for some generation, become strategically useful and feel right from an internal point of view. And, you know, so there's a constant contest going on. I think it's a constant process. I, with regard to the issue of polarization, I think we need to think about how hard it has been in recent years to have what you might call a public culture in the United States. Mm-hmm. Just look at the disputes over museum exhibits, mm-hmm. like the Enola Gay, and what happened in Hiroshima and the bombing of Japan. How are we going to tell that story? And given that public museums use tax money, people have very strong feelings about how their money is spent to tell what story with what consequences and implications. And we have had a number of cases where you actually can't put on the exhibit. Mm. That happened with the Freud exhibit at the Smithsonian. It happens in the context of representations of the history of relations with Native Americans, mm-hmm. the genocidal stories that can or cannot be told about that. And in a world in which we have identity politics and people who have huge stakes of all kinds in what kind of story is told, we are having an increasingly difficult time at the level of public culture.
All right, let's take another phone call before the end of our time. Let's talk with Artemis. Hello, Artemis.
Yes, hello.
Go ahead.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yes, my question, it's not a question, but it's a comment. I believe that memory has a very strong root to play in terms of holding on to history. I'm from an African culture where we believe strongly in oral history, like the griots. They are trained particularly for that effort to remember the history. Here, as much as it is told some time from the point of personal experience or from a collective experience, they also help to shape the history in which we as people in this present age and time can learn from it and also have our own form of interpretation of the past.
All right. Alison Lansbury, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point. And I think it's always been the case that there has been a very powerful connection between memory and history. And certainly cultures where oral history plays an integral role, it's certainly the case that memory narratives are hugely important in the construction of and consolidation of a sense of collective past and shared destiny. And I think that's quite important. One thing that I would add to that is I think that it's becoming increasingly possible for people, even in American society, to engage with history in a more active way. And I think that that's the direction that a lot of history museums have taken, museums like the Holocaust Museum, where people are put in a more active role vis-a-vis history and are made to engage more directly with the past. And I know that there are several university sites now where the Center for History and New Media, George Mason, is one of them, where there's a lot of effort being put into making it more possible for people, for sort of everyday Americans, to contribute to the historical narrative, to participate using the Internet in the collecting and the writing of history in a way that wasn't always possible.
Let me ask you, just in our final few minutes, Alison Lansberg, as you look at the unfolding of events from September 11th onward, what do you see as the evolving relationship between these personal stories, which are so available for a variety of reasons, and the evolving larger story? What is the connection that's forming between memory and history in this particular case?
Well, I think one of the things that I definitely see is that, because there was so much loss in this event and so much private loss, I think that it will inevitably be the case that we'll continue to sort of to hear about this and see this event as the story of good versus evil. And I don't, I don't know how productive that will ultimately be in sorting out what actually happened, but because such a tragic event occurred and because there was so much loss, I think it's going to be difficult, at least in the near future, to be able to move beyond to sort of get at the political situation that led to this great grave tragedy.
Okay. Allison Landsberg is Assistant Professor of History and Art History at George Mason University. She's been joining us today from her home in Virginia. Richard Schwader, let me ask you the same question. How do you see the connection between these two processes unfolding in this particular instance?
Yeah, just before I answer that question, I just wanted a quick comment on the last commentator who called in. I think it was a very important comment because you can see that when you are trying to establish a sense of connection to the past, that sense of connection to the past is not simply an act of consuming an historical narrative of some type, especially the historical narratives of other peoples. It's very much tied up with remembering your ancestors. There's a very specific sense of descent and connection that people have, which is tied to what I think Allison had to say about shared destiny and some kind of collectivity. And we don't yet live in a world in which that sense of shared destiny is universally distributed over the entire globe. It seems to me that people identify with certain kinds of groups, and they have their ancestors, and they feel somewhat differently about their own ancestors than they do about others' ancestors. And we need to recognize that, whether our humanism leads us to feel that that's a terrible thing, or whether our valuing of diversity leads us to recognize that, of course, there must be specific attachments to specific ancestors. Either way, we have to recognize that we don't live globally, and that oral histories are the histories of your people and your ancestors, and there need to be some set of people who care about their own thick ethnicity and are dug in and want it to go forward and develop and are not simply sitting on the internet consuming each other's stories.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very big difference, it seems to me, in the relationship to the past that comes from those two kinds of strategies.
Okay.
With
you know what? We're actually out of time.
Okay.
So I'm sorry. I have to cut you off. Richard Schwader is a cultural anthropologist and professor of human development at the University of Chicago. His forthcoming book is called Emerging Cultural Differences, The Multicultural Challenge in Liberal Democracies. And he joined us today from the campus of the University of Chicago. Richard Schwader, Allison Landsberg, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling in. Apologies to those whose calls we couldn't get to. I'd like to also thank the folks who helped bring the program to you today. Our sound engineer, Steve Warnauskas, senior producer, Joshua Andrews, and associate producer, Allison Cuddy. The managing producer of Odyssey is Edward Lipson. Our program is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I am Gretchen Helfrich, and you have been listening to Odyssey.
Odyssey is marketed and distributed by Marja Strushko. Funding for the program is provided by a generous grant from Doris Sasser and the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen to this show again, go to our website, chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey. You can find information there on how to order a tape of the show. That's chicagopublicradio.org/odyssey.